God's people and their homeland. That's really what we're concerned about in these final chapters of the book of Numbers, chapters 26 to 36. The new homeland that God was bringing them into. Now, they had taken about 40 years to get there because the people had been rebellious and had suffered God's punishment as a result. But now they've got to the stage where they're about to cross the river and take possession of this land. But before they do so, there are various things to be sorted out. And if you look there at chapter 26, you find it looks pretty uninteresting. Lots and lots of names and families and so forth. Well, let me comfort your hearts by assuring you we're not going to read it. The purpose of this census was to update the thing. They had run a census 40 years earlier, but of course it was now out of date because a new generation had grown up. So now we have another census, and the book of Numbers takes its name from these two census that were run. The purpose of the census here was partly to assess who was eligible for military service, because they had to conquer the land ahead of them, but also to work out the numbers in the different tribes so that they could break the land up accordingly. And so you have all the different tribes mentioned there. Now, the way it worked when they divided the tribes was to give an area proportionate to the number of people in each tribe. Greater number of people, larger area. Smaller number of people, smaller area. But where the different tribes were located within the land of Canaan that they were moving into depended upon the drawing of lots. That's pointed out in chapter 26, verse 54. To a large tribe you shall give a large inheritance, and to a small tribe you shall give a small inheritance. Every tribe shall be given its inheritance according to its numbers, but the land shall be divided by lot, that is, the places where they go. That was to be decided by the drawing of lots. But a problem arose in chapter 27, because the allocation of the inheritance, and if we use the word inheritance, we're talking about the land that they inherited when they went into Canaan and carved it up. The different families within the different tribal groups received their inheritance. The inheritance was arranged through the male members of the family. The male members carried on the family name, much as happens in our society, and they were the ones who were the heirs of the property as it passed on from one generation to the next. So it carried on through the male descendants. But a difficulty arose when a man by the name of Zelophehad died, and he had no sons. He had only daughters, five of them in fact, and they were a bit put out, and understandably so, that they may have been left with no land, because they had no brothers and no other next of kin or near of kin who were males. And so they said, it means that we're eventually going to lose out on any property in the coming distribution. So Moses in chapter 27 verse 5 did a very sensible thing. He brought their case before the Lord. And we have seen that consistently in the book of Numbers, that Moses wasn't one to make rash decisions. He brought the case before the Lord and waited for God to show him, which I think is some sort of guideline for us to follow. Well, God showed him what to do in verse 7. He said, the daughters of Zelophehad are right. You shall give them possession of inheritance among their father's brethren, and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. And you shall say to the people of Israel, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. We're going to find that there's a variation on that later on, but if you can file that fact away for the time being, at least it satisfies the daughters of Zelophehad for now, and I hope it satisfies us. You find, as you get to the end of chapter 27, verse 20, for example, that Joshua is to be invested with some of Moses' authority and is to take on the job after Moses as the civil leader of the nation. But he didn't have the same unique position that Moses had. Joshua had to share the leadership with Eleazar the priest, and from this point on, the civil and religious leaderships of the nation were separate. And so you notice that there in verse 20 that Eleazar is in charge of the religious affairs, and Joshua in charge of the civil affairs. Later on, when you come to the division of the land, we find that those two men were jointly involved. That's just by the way. Before we speak further concerning other issues in relation to the coming homeland, there are various things talked about in chapters 28 to 30 that I'll touch on briefly. Now, chapters 28 and 29 are again a couple of those chapters that you skip over if you possibly can, because they outline all the different sacrifices that were offered through the year. It comes as a surprise to us sometimes to realize that the people of Israel offered sacrifices every day. There was a national sacrifice every morning and every evening, a burnt offering symbolizing the consecration of the people to God. It's referred to there in verse 3, day by day, a continual offering. And so they had to present one animal in the morning and one animal in the evening, and these burnt constantly by means of a slow fire operating on the altar. And so it went on morning, evening, day by day throughout the generations. And I think the significance of that should not be lost on us. It tells us that this devotion, this consecration to God, was a constant thing. And I'm sure that many of us have the wrong idea about this. I think a lot of us think that we got consecrated to God on such and such a date, or we took Christ as our Savior on such and such a date, or we dedicated ourselves to God, or we had some particular experience, and we really get our money's worth out of that experience. We think of it all the time, we write the date in the back of our Bible and things like that, and somehow we think that because we've gone through that, we've arrived. Well, it doesn't quite work like that. Our devotion to God, our consecration, our dedication to God is an ongoing thing. It's a constant thing, day by day, morning and evening, morning and evening. We can't afford to let up on this. And if our devotion to God is not a regular thing, then it needs to be looked into. And here the people were reminded that their commitment to God was something that was a daily responsibility, and I believe it is with you and me also. But there weren't only the daily offerings. You cast your eye down to verse 9 and you find on every Sabbath day, likewise, there were offerings. And these in verse 10, we are told, were in addition to the regular daily offerings. But there's more to come in verse 11. At the beginning of every month, more offerings again in addition to the others. And so it goes on. Daily, weekly, monthly, this consistency in the people's devotion to God. That's the way, I believe, to Christian growth also. Consistency. I think there are too many of us that we're high-flying one minute and then we're a bit down in the dumps another minute, and then we look for special shots in the arm and things like that to thump us along and keep us moving in our Christian life. But there's no substitute for this regular daily grind, if I can use that word, the constant work of simply building. And as we look at the daunting task of understanding the Bible, for example, we may think that it's an impossible task, but by wearing away at it constantly, we're going to find that it really does rub off on us, and in the long run we're going to be much better for laying a very solid and even foundation than going from crisis to crisis, hoping for some further shot from the Lord to keep us going until the next one comes. And so here I believe these are some of the things that are talked about in the consistency and the regularity of the religious exercises of the people. And then through the rest of chapter 28, it talks about the annual festivals. So we've had daily, weekly, monthly, and now annual. Passover mentioned in verse 16, Feast of First Fruits or Pentecost in verse 26, through to chapter 29, verse 1, the blowing of trumpets in preparation for the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement in verse 7, verse 12, the Feast of Tabernacles, otherwise known as the Feast of Shelters. And so it goes on. Now I'm not going to go into the details of any of those feasts. What these chapters are concerned with is detailing the numbers of sacrifices to be offered on those occasions. And when you come to the last one, which is the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Shelters, when they lived in shelters in memory of their extended time of wandering in the wilderness, the numbers of sacrifices are enormous. It was a real beano, this one, but it went on for a week, and a considerable feasting, merriment and joy accompanied the ingathering of the harvest of grapes and dates and all sorts of other things. It was quite a time. But there were many, many sacrifices. If you counted up all the sacrifices mentioned in those couple of chapters, it comes to a few hundred per year, that is. You come now to verse 39, and we notice something here that we've seen consistently in the book of Numbers, and in fact you'll find it consistently right through these books of Moses. Verse 39, and these you shall offer to the Lord at your appointed feasts, in addition to your offerings for vows, free will offerings, and other offerings. In addition to. One of the points that we've noticed is that time and again there is always room for what I call the over and above, the extras, the in addition to types of service. Many of us feel that we have certain responsibilities. We may vow to the Lord to do a certain thing, and I hope we do it. But whenever we've done that thing, we still haven't finished. There is still room for the extra, for the over and above. And once again, we could refer to that conversation between our Lord and his disciples when it was brought before them that when they had done everything in their service and devotion to the Lord, they had, after all, merely done their duty. And so it is with us. The real test, often, is not simply the things that we do as part of our duty. It's the extras, the over and above, which really indicates the genuineness or otherwise of a person's devotion to God. And so there it is again in verse 39. And then chapter 30 is a rather odd chapter. It is concerned with vows. Vows were promises that people made to God, maybe in response to something God had done for them, or perhaps as an expression of devotion to God for something they wanted to do for God. And so a person might make a vow. The trouble is that we tend to make those vows at times a little rashly, and the Bible is constantly giving warning about making rash vows, because we are required to do what we promise to do. And the Bible is very strong on this point, that once we've said we're going to do a thing, then we do it. And it's a point that Christians too often fall down on. It's very consistent in the Bible. There are a number of things that are very consistent in the Bible, such as not lying, not stealing, and not breaking your word. Take notice of those things. And this latter one that I mentioned there of not breaking your word is one that I'm afraid people too often neglect. Something happens and they say, oh, I was busy, I couldn't turn up, after having told the person they were going to do something, or they'd be at the working bee, or they'd pull their weight with the young people's group, or they were going to help to do something else, and then they say, oh, something cropped up and I couldn't come. Well, if something crops up, such as you get your head cut off, well, that's a different thing. But the sorts of things that are given as excuses are really not valid. And we must be prepared to inconvenience ourselves in order to keep our word. And that's part of the mark of a person who's serious about his Christianity. Vows were important. Now, in ancient times, they had various formal ways of making vows and following them through. Here, it talks about a man who made a vow and then a woman who made a vow. In verse 2 of chapter 30, it says, when a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. So that's the man. Now verse 3 concerns the woman. And I'm afraid Germaine Greer is not going to like this. When a woman vows a vow to the Lord and binds herself by a pledge, while within her father's house in her youth, and her father hears of her vow and of her pledge by which she has bound herself and says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father expresses disapproval to her on the day that he hears of it, no vow of hers, no pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father opposed her. And then in verse 6 it talks about a married woman. The verses we just read concerned a single woman. Verse 6 concerns a married woman. And to summarize without reading it all through again, what he's saying is this. When a woman makes a vow, the vow could be changed or cancelled by the woman's father, in the case of a single woman, or by the woman's husband, in the case of a married woman. Provided, he voiced his objection on the day that he heard the vow. As it says there in the verses we just read, he must do so on the day. If he doesn't voice his objection then, well, then the vow stands. Silence means consent. But supposing something goes wrong later on and the lady fouls it all up, and she's taken a vow, which is a rather stupid thing to do in the first place, and now she's found she can't carry her vow through, or it's created complications for her or somebody else, and so the husband or the father, as the case may be, then mutters something like, stupid woman, I knew it wasn't going to work, and he then steps in and decides he's going to stop all this nonsense. Now, he can't do that. If he does do that, the total responsibility for the broken vow rests on him, and all the punishment of God now falls on his shoulders. Well, that's fair enough, isn't it? I mean, you can't have your cake and eat it too. And we've got to make up our minds on this. If he decides to pull his rank on his wife or his daughter, then he should do so on the very day that he heard the vow. It's too late to come back later and then try to force the person to change. You see, the responsibility is there. And I find that a very sobering statement. I think we can learn something from that. I mean, there are areas of responsibility that as fathers and as husbands we have, but too often we want to have all the good things and not accept the responsibilities that go with it. And too often you find husbands and fathers, they like to assert their authority at different times, but in what I would call an irresponsible way. If he doesn't agree with something, he's got to say so at the time. Otherwise, the thing stands. It's a little bit as we say in English, or in Australian might be a better way of putting it, I suppose. You speak up, you put up or shut up, something like that. That's Australian. You put up or shut up. I think English would say something like, speak now or forever hold your peace. That's it. There's no sense coming back later and saying, you stupid woman, you shouldn't have done that in the first place. You see, there's the person who wants to have his authority and then use it later on to bail himself out. If he steps in, then he bears the total responsibility. Now, when you examine that and think it through, although it may not appeal to modern ears when you first read those verses, I think on reflection you'll find it's a fairly even-handed type of justice that's talked about here, and there's a certain balance which is a good warning to anybody who happens to carry any sort of responsibility in the family or anywhere else for that matter. Well, I'm not going to pursue that further. You can follow it through if you think it's worth pursuing further. But I just point out verse 15 to show you that what I've said is, in fact, in the Bible. In verse 15, if he makes the vows null and void after he has heard them, then he bears her iniquity. Fair enough. Well, getting back now to the point concerning Israel and the inheritance in the coming homeland. We're going to skip over chapter 31 because we looked at that this morning. We come to chapter 32. And this concerns the land which had been occupied. And just to refresh your minds on what has happened. In the chapters that have just gone before, the people of Israel had moved up on the eastern side of the Dead Sea and the eastern side of the Jordan River. And they had taken possession of all this land. The southern part was formerly the land of Moab. The middle part is often referred to as the land of Gilead. And the northern part often referred to as the land of Bashan. These areas had been occupied by two Amorite kings, Zion and Og. They'd both been defeated by the invading Israelites. They were under the ban that God had placed on these iniquitous people, so they got their deserts. The people of Israel have now taken control of all this area, and it turns out to be a very good area for cattle raising. Over the previous 40 years, many of the Israelites had developed a certain degree of expertise in raising sheep and cattle. They weren't very clever at that back in Egypt because they had little opportunity to do that, seeing they were working as labourers in government building projects. But over the intervening 40 years, they had accumulated quite a lot of cattle and they'd been breeding fairly successfully. And some of the people of Israel said, look, this is good pasture land. We'd like to settle here instead of going across the river into Canaan. Just to clarify our terms here, the word Canaan, strictly speaking, refers to that portion of land between the Jordan River on the east and the Mediterranean Sea on the west. This other area here is often referred to as Transjordan, or if you like, over Jordan or east of Jordan. 2.5 tribes said, we would like to stay here east of Jordan. We'll settle here instead of going into Canaan. The suggestion had some merit, I suppose, but Moses was a bit frightened of it at first, because it occurred to him that this could be a repetition of the sort of faithlessness and rebellion that they had met 40 years previously back in Kadesh Barnea. Remember when they sent the spies up and they said, let's go in, and then the rest of them said, oh no, it's going to be too difficult to conquer the people and it's a land full of well-fortified cities and all the rest of it. And so they discouraged the hearts of the people and they didn't go in. Moses is a bit frightened that the same thing is going to happen again. That when these 2.5 tribes say, no, we'll settle here instead of going over the river, it might discourage the rest of the people from going on with the battle. So that's what chapter 32 talks about. For example, in verse 6, Moses said to the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, incidentally you'll find that the half tribe of Manasseh joins them, so it's 2.5 tribes really. If you look back to verse 1, you find that they talk about the land of Gilead as being a good place for cattle, and that was their reason for putting this request. But back to verse 6 again, he said, shall your brethren go to the war while you sit here? Why will you discourage the heart of the people of Israel from going over into the land which the Lord has given them? That's what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. Is it going to happen again? Whereupon the 2.5 tribes put a compromise proposal to Moses. And they said, fair enough. What we'll do is this. We'll build houses for our families and booths and cattle yards for our stock. They can stay here and we'll go across with the rest of the army and we'll fight the battle in Canaan, and when the battle is over and we've taken possession of the land, then we'll come back and we'll settle down. Moses thought to himself, well, that's a fair enough proposal, and so he accepted. And so that was the arrangement. And just another interesting point here, if you read the story on further and go into the book of Joshua, you find that the 2.5 tribes kept their promise. 10 out of 10, full marks. Here we see people who were loyal to their word, which is the point that I was trying to get across earlier. A good example of it here in these 2.5 tribes. And after they'd joined in the conquest, they went back and settled with their families. The land on that side of Jordan, those 2.5 tribes, was a good land. It was good for pasturing, and it was quite wealthy agriculturally. But it was very vulnerable, as you can see by looking at the map. the Jordan formed a very good river against attack from this side. It was very hard to get across the Jordan because of its steep banks and thickets and other features of the terrain. As a result, these 2.5 tribes were very open to attack, and in fact they crumbled before the rest of Israel. As you move on later into the story, they were among the first of the people to be taken into captivity in the later stories that you meet as you go through the Old Testament. But that's just by the way. Before we leave the story, at the end of chapter 32, if you look at verse 33, you'd get the confirmation of what I said about Gad, Reuben, and half the tribe of Manasseh being the 2.5 tribes. And the land that they possessed was the former kingdom of Zion and Og, the two Amorite kings. So that ties in what I said with the verses there. Going down to verse 39, one of the families of Manasseh, family of Machir, they went and took a bit of extra land while they were at it. They grabbed some more just to make their own inheritance a bit more secure and prosperous. And so it talks there in the final 3 or 4 verses about the villages which they took control of. I just mention that because that again is going to recur in the story. We come now to chapter 33, which mainly is a summary of the journey from Egypt. And it talks about all the different camps they had along the way. Then you come to chapter 34, and it gives the boundaries of the land which has been possessed. Now, I'm not going to go through those boundaries. If you look in verse 34, verse 3, it mentions the south side, verse 6, the western side, verse 7, the northern side, and verse 10, the eastern side. If you look at the map, it's very simple. Mediterranean on the west, the headwaters of the Jordan River up here, bordering on Phoenicia, was the north. The Jordan River was the east, and then going around the bottom of the desert back to the Mediterranean Sea was the south. That area of Canaan, we are told in chapter 34, verse 13, was divided between 9.5 tribes. So Canaan itself was never divided between the 12 tribes. It was only divided between 9.5 tribes, because the other 2.5 got their land east of Jordan. Chapter 34, verse 13. Moses commanded the people of Israel, saying, "This is the land which you shall inherit by lot, which the Lord has commanded to give to the 9 tribes and to the half tribe." For the tribe of Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh had got their inheritance on the other side of the river. Verse 15. The 2 tribes and half a tribe received their inheritance beyond the Jordan, other side. Verse 16, we see that Eleazar the priest and Joshua the civil leader were the 2 in charge of the division of the land. Moving on then to chapter 35, we are told about the remaining tribe. The remaining tribe, of course, being the tribe of Levi. And the tribe of Levi was the tribe that provided all the religious officials for the nation of Israel. Now, because they were the religious officials, they did not have a tribal portion all of their own. Instead, they were scattered right through all 12 tribes. And they were given cities within each of the tribes. 48 cities altogether, the number of cities per tribe being in proportion to the population of the tribe. But in this way, the servants of God were well scattered around the nation and so able to instruct and to teach the people concerning the religion of Jehovah. And again, there's a good point there concerning the distribution of God's servants, so that there is a good even spread and we don't concentrate our activity in the comfortable spots and all scratch each other's backs and have cozy fellowships and forget about the areas far flung where very often there is a great neglect in the things of God and in the work of God. Here we find an even spread. And I think the Western world has to bear a great judgment because of a lack of even spread and a lack of concern to do something about it. We come to chapter 35 then, and the 48 cities, which are talked about in verse 2, it says, "Command the people of Israel to give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to dwell in with pasture lands round about." We saw this morning that the Levites got animals given to them as part of their wages, and they could eat them or sell them or breed them, and so they had pasture lands for their animals. The cities in all, 48, referred to in verse 7, and in verse 8 it says that the larger tribe shall have many and the smaller tribes shall have few. Each in proportion to the inheritance, so shall the cities be spread around the various tribes. Within these 48 cities were 6 cities which were called cities of refuge. You notice them referred to in verse 11, cities of refuge, and in verse 14 we are told that 3 of these cities were to be east of Jordan, and 3 of them were to be west of Jordan in Canaan. And later on, when you get into Joshua and you find they were allocated with 1 city in the north, 1 in the centre, and 1 in the south, in each case, making up the six, three on either side of the river. A very sensible arrangement, meaning that everybody lived within reach of a city of refuge. The point of having a city of refuge was to provide safety for a person who had unintentionally killed somebody else. Now, there is some misunderstanding, I feel, at times concerning these cities of refuge. People think that a murderer could escape to a city of refuge and so be safe. Well, that is not the case. The city of refuge was there for the person who had been responsible for somebody else's death accidentally. Now, whether it was accidentally, of course, is a debatable point. That's why we have courts of law here to decide whether it was manslaughter or murder. So the person could escape to the city until the case was decided. Because, as you know, people get square very quickly. And in some of these primitive societies, there's a great system of payback in operation. It operates in some of the countries of the world still. People get square by getting revenge on behalf of a person who's been murdered by another clan or another tribe. They'll take anybody sometimes, if they can get the real murderer, good and well, but if they can't get the murderer, they'll go for anybody that they can grab. And so there's a payback system. Now, that operated in all the world of the Middle East, and I guess it operated in Israel, and it wasn't a particularly good thing. But to protect the people, there were cities of refuge built, so that if a person had been responsible for another person's death, he could escape to the city of refuge, and he would be safe inside that city until such time as the case came before the judges. Now, when the case came before the judges, if the person was found guilty of murder, he was executed. That was the penalty. There was no safety for him if he had been guilty of willful murder. Life for life. God treats murder as a serious offence, because God has human life in high esteem. God puts a high value on human life. There's a certain sacredness about human life which is not shared by other animals. Because man is unique in God's creation, man alone was made in God's image. And from the beginning, God has said that the person who murders another has taken the life that really belonged to God. God is the owner of all life, and God gives this life to people. And so he says, if a person willfully murders another person, then that person has by that act declared himself unworthy to enjoy further God's gift of life. And therefore, if a man takes another person's life in that way, his life in turn is taken. And that's the penalty that was laid down. Now, this operated in Israel. Murder polluted the land, the Bible says. And the only expiation of that pollution was through the removal of the guilty person. So the murderer was not safe. But what about the unintentional killer? The person who had been in an accident or had been responsible for another person's death, but he hadn't tried to kill the person. Now, he was very vulnerable because the relatives of the dead person might try to catch him and kill him in revenge. So he escaped to the city of refuge. His case was brought before the tribunal, and if it was found that he was not guilty of willful murder, then no penalty was laid upon him. He was, however, required to stay within the city of refuge for his own safety, but also as a sort of partial punishment. His freedom was restricted, but at least he was safe. So again, it's a fairly even-handed dealing with the situation, and he could remain in that city as long as he wished. He had at least to remain until the death of the high priest, which probably indicated the end of an era, and then if he wanted to, he could go home. But if he didn't want to go home, he could stay where he was and just enjoy life in the safety of the city. So there you see again a very sensible arrangement that was made, and one of the things that I think has struck us through these studies in Numbers is that God is concerned with practical arrangements which are going to help people. As Christians, we get a bit high-flying at times and too spiritual for our own good. We don't anchor our faith enough in the nitty-gritty of everyday life. We don't bring our faith to bear upon the problems of everyday life. Too often we say, it will all be okay when we get to heaven. Well, so it will be, but that doesn't solve the present problems. And there's no point in opting out of our present problems through some vague hope of a better life in the blue beyond. Our faith must be relevant, and here in these Old Testament books we can see good examples of how teaching concerning God was put to good use for the practical benefit of the people. Now, just to refer to a few verses there so that you get the connection and you see how it is actually said in the Bible, let us look at chapter 35, verse 10. Say to the people of Israel, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, notice the terminology again, cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, just defining Canaan as the land between Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, then you shall select cities to be cities of refuge for you. that the manslayer who kills any person without intent, mind you, may flee there. The city shall be for you a refuge from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die, and hear the words, until he stands before the congregation for judgment. He comes before the government tribunal. And the cities which you shall give shall be 6 cities of refuge, 3 in Canaan, and 3 on the other side of Jordan. Verse 16, if it's found that the case was one of willful murder, if he struck him down with an instrument of iron so that he died, then he's a murderer, and the murderer shall be put to death, as is explained in verse 33. You shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood, that is the blood of a person murdered, pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed in it, except by the blood of him who shed it. As for the unintentional death, the manslayer, what we would today call manslaughter, in contrast to willful murder, you find that referred to in verse 28. For the man must remain in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest, but after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. He may return. If he chooses not to, well, that's okay. He may think it's safer to stay there indefinitely. Just to wrap it up, a couple of notes in chapter 36. Remember, a couple of chapters ago, we saw that some of the adventurous young men from the tribe of Manasseh grabbed a bit more land while they were at it. And they were of the family of Machir, we see, in verse 1. They're referred to chapter 36, verse 1. And the land that they grabbed was this land east of Jordan. They belonged to the half-tribe of Manasseh that had settled east of Jordan. Now, a problem arose because of that extra land that they had grabbed. And I suppose, looking after their own interests before anybody else's, they thought to themselves, what if these daughters of Zelophehad marry chaps from another tribe? Because the daughters of Zelophehad belonged to this family in the tribe of Manasseh that had just got this extra territory. Now, the inheritance, as we saw earlier, passed through the male descendants. Supposing these daughters of Zelophehad, the 5 of them, supposing one or all of them married men from another tribe, they produce a child, and the child carries the name of the father. And so the inheritance then goes to the child, but he is child of a father from a different tribe. And so the land that has been allotted originally to the tribe of Manasseh could be lost to another tribe if one of these women married a man from that other tribe. So they brought the problem to Moses. And Moses again asks the Lord's advice. And in verse 6, this is what the Lord said concerning the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them marry whom they think best. Well, that's a concession, isn't it? Let them marry whom they think best, only they shall marry within the family of the tribe of their father. And in that way, it was going to ensure that the just and fair distribution of land, which was given under Joshua and Eleazar, was maintained. And as you read on the story further, you find that the division which Joshua and Eleazar worked out among the 12 tribes was indeed very fair according to the populations of the different tribes. And then that land was passed on in perpetuity to the descendants and their descendants and their descendants, so that there was no possibility, in theory anyway, of rich and greedy people gobbling up the land of others. The whole idea was to get this inheritance passed on and so maintain the justice and the fairness of the original distribution. And this little proviso here in chapter 36 is just another point to see that that fairness is maintained throughout. One of those indications we've had time and time again of the fairness that you find characteristic of the law of Moses. And Christians sometimes compare unfavorably with some of these people in ancient times, because we too are rather self-centered at times, and we have very good ways of justifying the things we want to do. We manipulate numbers, we have little schemes and bits of skullduggery we get up to at times, and we're not entirely fair. And here's a reminder that above all, there must be honesty and openness, above all, surely, among God's people. And if we can't be honest and open and fair with each other, how on earth are we going to be that with anybody else? Well, so there it is, the book of Numbers. A quick run through. We've seen some of the requirements which God laid upon his people in times past. And I trust that as we've looked at those things, we might find some instruction for us who are God's people today.